Relay. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode 94, recorded April the 30th, 2025. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me, again, is Joe Adalian, a vulture. Joe, welcome back to Downstream. Good to have you here.
Jason, thank you as always for having me on. Episode 94, I feel like we should be talking about one of the greatest seasons in TV history, 1994. Friends, ER, both debuted. Big year.
Good times. Good times. Whatever happened to those people? Oh, yeah, they all became really famous.
No one ever talks about Friends or ER, ever.
No, not even a little. I wanted to go back further in time.
1894, there was no TV then, sir.
I wanted to go back to one of my memories of as a kid was watching Match Game, which was often styled with Gene Rayburn, which was often styled as Match Game 75, Match Game 79, just because
Match Game PM,
you wouldn't want to confuse it with other Match Games. And it was, you know, it's just a game show where there's celebrity panel of, in hindsight, as a child, I didn't quite realize this, drunk celebrities, doing fill in the blank kind of things, trying to help out two contestants. And I, this is not even quite streaming, but I don't care. It's about television, the past, present, and future of television, that, you had some news that Martin Short is going to host a new version of the Match Game. And, you know, I love the format. I love the choice of Martin Short to do it. I just have such a soft spot for those celebrity panel game shows. I love them so much.
I do too. And I'm optimistic about this. You know, look, I just rediscovered Match Game. Obviously, we grew up the same time. I remember Match Game. I didn't watch it a whole bunch as a kid, or I don't have strong memories. And then I would watch it when Game Show Network would put it on. Yeah. It was there. It wasn't until sort of like really Buzzer came around and you know, episodes on YouTube became easy to watch, that I really sort of, I had my Match Game era for a couple of years, where I would watch an episode every day. I'm not there anymore. I might go back. Right now I'm in my password era. So it's always a super password or password plus for me. It's my daily dose, but I do love the Match Game format because it is, you know, people talk about the British inventing panel shows, and maybe they did, but certainly in its own way, even though Match Game was not at all tied to current events at all, it was a panel show. It was a bunch of people, of Hollywood people, just celebrities, sort of just, you know, having a lot of fun with average people, you know, before social media. This is how we got to see our celebrities, and admittedly, they were mostly B celebrities at the time.
Sure.
The Hollywood Squares, I think, actually had a much higher star wattage, but no, it's great. And I was very happy. I was, for years, you know, let me tell you your little backstory. People will probably recall, unless they have the memories of Nats, which, let's face it, after COVID and everything else, a lot of people do, you know, that ABC revived it in the modern era back in 2017 with Alec Baldwin. And that actually ran for 5 seasons, about 65 episodes. And I remember the work up to that, I had been pressuring Rob Mills, who's the head of Unscripted then for ABC, now for all of Disney, saying, you got to bring back Match Game. I just thought it made perfect sense. To me, the shows that needed to be back on network primetime were Match Game and Hollywood Squares. And I swear to God, anytime I talked to an Unscripted executive, starting around 2005, 2010, I was like, you got to bring those shows back. I always thought, especially Hollywood Squares, I thought would be great to have on in the summer because stars could come on and, or Match Game, because they could come on and promote their summer movies, right? That was sort of a thinking. Never seemed to really go anywhere. But then, thankfully, you know, network TV collapsed and suddenly networks needed really cheap programming. And lo and behold, Match Game is relatively cheap to produce.
Yeah.
And so Rob Mills, who's the head of Unscripted there and has been for a while, had the idea of bringing, you know, not had the idea. He finally said, call me up one day and said, Joe, we're doing it. And we're doing it with Alec Baldwin. I was like, what? but, you know, I like Alec Baldwin. I'm actually one of those people who don't hate him, even though he's like awful to press and has many other issues.
I think he's a great actor. Classic Letterman guest and SNL host. I mean,
he's very talented. He's a great actor. It always seems strange for Match Game, and I guess he was fine. And you know, he did an okay job. To me, someone like Alec Baldwin, all it does is it makes the show more expensive and harder to justify. But whatever. If it gets the green light and makes it network prime time, then sure. You know, and it ran and it did okay. The problem then, and it's even what the problem I have with this current version is, Match Game to really work, you need to do a lot of episodes. You need a cast that gels and has time to find a rhythm. And it's really hard in prime time when you only get 15 to 20 half hours every year. But that said, they're now having Martin Short on, and I'm optimistic. I'll take any Match Game. So I've now filibustered. But you know,
no, it's,
what do you think?
It's good. It's gonna be on ABC and then stream later on Hulu. You know, the classic. You mentioned 65 episodes for Alec Baldwin. That's literally 13 weeks of strip syndication mm-hmm. in the old days.
Yeah.
So, and yet it was five seasons. So, it doesn't need to be 5 days a week or anything, but yeah, lots of episodes and getting the cast to gel, because of course there was a classic Match Game cast back in the day. You had your Brett Summers, Charles Nelson Reilly, Fanny Flagg. I mean, you can name them, right? Richard Dawson. Like there were always Nipsey Russell, the classic B-listers, but funny, just funny people. And and Martin Short is fun, and he's in the family, right? Because of Only Murders in the Building. And
right.
So,
no, I heard,
good match. Oh,
yeah,
match.
No, it match. There we go. No, and here's some interesting things. Some people thought that, won't Martin Short be better as a panelist? And maybe he would definitely make sense as a panelist, but he also makes sense as a host, right? I mean, he can bring that manic energy. And more importantly, the reason I think Alec Baldwin was picked was because the thinking was Alec would be able to bring some of his friends to play with him. And he did. I mean, there were people from the 30 Rock universe and SNL who came onto the show because of Alec Baldwin. I think Martin Short does exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
We might even get Martin. We might even, maybe Alec Baldwin will be a panelist. Who knows? And I will say, by the way, 65 or so episodes, those were hour long episodes,
okay.
I think.
Fair
so
enough.
It's technically 130, but you're right. That's still less than one season.
Yeah.
Right. It's still less than one season. Yeah. It's not enough. And, I did an interview with Rob Mills that will probably, depending upon when you drop this episode, will just be coming out or will have just dropped. But, I asked him about the whole, to me, what I think really needs to happen with these kinds of shows is they need to find a way to make them for syndication. The syndication marketplace is very challenged right now, and it's probably Disney's not going to do that. But what they could do is they could do a virtual syndication for Hulu. Like, there's no reason you can't have something like this where every Friday Hulu drops five half-hour episodes of Match Game. Or even, God forbid, every day at the same time they're uploading all sorts of ABC shows, right? Why not have an episode of Match Game that premieres and do it 5 days a week? Amazon actually has done that with Judge Judy, their reboot of Judge Judy, and they sort of have had a pretty decent model. A lot of people binge it, but they've made hundreds and hundreds of episodes of sort of Judge Judy, the reboot. There's no reason you can't do that cost effectively if you have Hulu paying part of the bill. And I think it gives people a reason to want to open their app. So there is a streaming angle here, Jason.
Yeah.
I actually think streamers are not being, everyone thinks, well, it has to be premium. TV is streaming now, and people don't always need TV to be premium. We saw that with The Pitt, which is sort of premium, but it's really sort of network. Same thing with shows like formats like game shows,
yeah, reality shows.
And soap operas and reality shows.
Yep.
Make them, give me a Big Brother style show that's just for, and by the way, Hulu has found that. Hulu has had great success with Love Island, a format that didn't really work when it was on CBS because it was too narrow for their audience. But Hulu, Peacock with Love Island, every time, I've heard that every time that there's a new episode of Love Island drops on Peacock, openings of the app just surge. People jump onto it like it's a brand new episode of television, like it's Wednesday night at 8 o'clock and they're watching Survivor. So you can do the same. You got to give people a reason to make an appointment, and why not Match Game?
Sure.
What else would you reboot?
What else would I reboot? Oh, geez. I don't even know. I was actually talking to my wife last night about how a new season of Taskmaster is starting in the UK, and that'll be on YouTube in the US. And I thought, I still want them. I know they've tried and failed a couple of times to get that show to work in the US, but it's such a good show, and it works so well in so many different formats, because the New Zealand version is great. The Australian version is great. It's been successful in a bunch of different countries. And I thought, I think what they need to do is actually do what Bake Off did, which is fly Americans to the UK and use their staff and use their locations and just do an American slanted version of the British show instead of trying to create an American version of it. But that's similarly five comedians. They do 10 episode seasons. It's just, for those who haven't seen it yet, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's just delightful and fun and stupid and silly. And I feel like more stuff like that, that's the beauty of the panel show or the game show. Honestly,
yeah.
Joe, I would steal as many British, because Britain, because it's a smaller market, mm-hmm. they have always had a level of austerity that we haven't had to have in the US,
exactly.
but that is happening now, where you're saying, exactly, oh, we need it to be cheaper, but we need to put stuff on streaming. It's like, well, look at all the panel shows that they do in the UK, where they have the celebrities who are they're like comedic actors and they're comedians. And then they also on the side, like David Mitchell, who I keep recommending for the fact that he does Ludwig, one of my real finds this year.
So good.
I mean, and he's a sketch comedy guy. Mitchell and Webb mm-hmm. Look is one of the great sketch comedy shows of all time. They did Peep Show with the guy who went on to do Succession. But, you know, he also just hosts and guests on like panel shows. And it's just another part of the media environment in the UK. And I feel like we could pick up a lot more of that and just have more shows where we have lots of comedians and lots of funny character actors who don't work a lot that you could use.
Well, and, you know, there's been some movement towards that. CNN brought over, finally, Have I Got News For You, which has run for like almost 30 years, I think, in the UK and the BBC. And it's become one of my favorite shows. Have you watched it? Have I Got News For You, US?
I have not.
You know, I tend to stay away from most news programming these days for my mental health. I can only take so much of it. I can barely even watch John Oliver. I certainly don't watch Bill Maher, any of that. But you know the format, Have I Got News For You, yes, Jason?
Sure.
Should I explain it? Okay, yeah. But for anyone who doesn't, it's basically just a panel show with two regular team captains, two celebrities or newsmakers who sort of guest, and then Roy Wood Jr. is the host. And they sort of go through the week's news in sort of a game showy, sort of fun, sort of panel discussion way. It's really, really well done. And they brought it on CNN, and it does really well. Plus, I stream it on Max. But, you know, honestly, that could just as easily be a Max show as a CNN show, or both. It should stream live. It's just a matter of streamers and companies that have both streamers and linear networks figuring out a way to make it work and just to dive into it. And I think you're 100% right. You know, I'm trying to think, there was another one. Well, it slipped my mind, but I think there's been another recent move towards that as well. But I hope that I hope we will see more of that.
Yeah, it's the Would I Lie to You, QI, Unbelievable Truth. There's so many of them. Just don't steal them, America. Just license them. They're available cheap. And start with Taskmaster. Find a way to do that.
Although, you know what. You know, one last thing on that. I remember what I was going to say. CBS did sort of have its version, the After Midnight or After Whatever called.
After Midnight.
At Night, yeah. That one, like, again, that was one where the company, if they weren't just so messed up right now, but that's one that should definitely be, you know, paid for out of the budget of Paramount Plus, too. But that's absolutely a way that should work. And CBS, again, with Love Island, wasn't right for CBS. But my God, I think ABC or NBC, I think that show would work really well. I think that would work as a much better lead out of Nightline, which is basically the ghost of Nightline these days. And it's just there to justify the news division's budget. But that would probably work much better after Kimmel.
So I'm going to mention something that's not really news, but it's been treated as if it's news. So I guess it's an official thing. Speaking of expensive, prestigious TV shows, my favorite show from last year, which is also everybody's favorite show because it won the Emmy, is Shogun. And it adapted a book. They adapted the whole book. And it's this classic thing where, like, yeah, but what if you adapt a whole book and then everybody loves it? You just do a second season and make something up. And that is, they officially now have announced, and this is going to be, again, FX and Hulu, that they're bringing back Shogun for season two. They've broken a story. This is Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, who are the showrunners. And they, you know, and I think they work with James Clavell, the author of the novel. They've got the approval of the family, who loves the fact that his books are back in the news. And they're going to do, they've signed up Hiroyuki Sanada, who is the breakout star, I think, is Lord Torinaga on that, and he's going to be an exec producer, and they're paying everybody a lot of money to come back, and they're going to shoot it up in British Columbia again, just as they did for season one. And I don't know what I feel about, inventing another story. Cause you know, that story was invented by James Clavell in the 70s. And now these modern people have to sort of imagine what would book two have been, essentially, and structure it. That said, the show is so good and looked so good that I'm willing to give them, you know, my attention. And I'm glad that, that FX has swept in and said, yes, absolutely. We want to, I mean, really, it's like you won all the Emmys. Why would we not bring you back?
And so, well, I think that's the whole reason why they're bringing it back.
There
and,
it is.
And also, look, I will use this to get up on my soapbox. Shogun was a miniseries. It was a limited series.
Of course it was.
And it should not have competed in the series. But here's the thing. There is a rich history in American television of miniseries having sequels.
Yeah.
North and South, Book Two.
Sure.
War and Remembrance, Winds of War Beget War and yeah. Remembrance, which was based on an actual follow-up novel from Herman Woke. Was his name Woke or Walk? I don't
Woke.
Know. Woke, yes. He was the original. He was Woke.
Yes.
And I read that novel as a kid because I was a weird kid. But
I read Shogun as a kid. So
well, there
fair
you go.
Enough.
There you go. And so to me, this is, you know, it just, this is a sequel. This is, let's call it what it really is, a sequel. And I think if you look at it that to that degree, it makes sense because I'm sure it will be. I'm sorry to admit that I have not watched this Shogun or the original Shogun. I am Shogun free.
Wow.
At some point, I will get around to it. I know. I'm scared by subtitles. I have the attention span of a gnat. But
there's a dub version, although you shouldn't watch it.
I know. You're yes. Oh God, I'm going to be dub shamed. We have this debate at Vulture, and I'm just like, no, I will watch
it.
The dub, and you cannot make me. But although sometimes I will. Definitely note that if the dub's so bad, like, yeah, it takes away because it's so clearly not good. But anyway, and so I think if they do know the characters, these writers know the characters, they certainly departed a lot from the original miniseries, from everything I can understand, I've read.
Yeah.
Even if the thematically. So I, you know, will it be good? Of course, who knows, you know? But I don't think there's anything as shameless as it is, and as it's just because, you know, I think they needed to commit to it just so that it could be classified in the series category
right.
for the last Emmys, and they wanted to win those Emmys and you know, not compete with themselves. Because I think FX also had something in miniseries for that year too, right? I think they did. They win the miniseries,
right.
Yeah. So they wanted to get both. So you know, I think you know if you think of it as a sequel, and don't worry about what you call it. You know what, the sequel? Why not? I mean, there's it's certainly epic. Everything about Shogun is epic. So why should it be contained?
Yeah. And it doesn't it doesn't have a really pat ending. It really sort of like and then it goes on, and well, what happens next? And there's no answer to that in the novel. I mean, there is in history, but not in the novel. So you can build something else up. I just want to say Justin Marks made my favorite TV show of maybe, you know, the last decade, which is Counterpart. So I'm very happy that he and his wife have made another, you know, a huge hit, because nobody watched Counterpart, even though it was great and it got canceled after its initial 20 episode order. But
And then Stars, I think, removed it and erased it from history. It was one of the first shows that got disappeared.
I think it's on somewhere
economics.
Else now. But
they finally moved it somewhere else. Yeah, but I remember being tipped
so
off to that, and
so good.
And it was the canary in the coal mine for what Max and other places would start doing in terms of like writing down, shows because of streaming economics.
Yeah.
But yeah.
All right. I wanted to move on and just briefly mention there's a piece of Vulture that you were involved with, which involved a sort of a poll of a survey of TV viewers. And I just wanted to mention it because it gives us a little bit of an insight on like behavior of TV viewers. And I thought it was fascinating too, because it broke viewers down into binge watchers and scheduled watchers, which I guess I'm a scheduled watcher more than I'm a binge watcher. Cause I have a life. I have things to do. I can't sit and watch a whole TV show in a sitting. But what also fascinated me is the behaviors aren't that different. It turns out people like to know how many episodes there are in a season. People like the ability to autoplay the next episode without a break. And what they don't like are cliffhangers and previews of the next episode, which is hilarious because you think the behavior might be different, but it's not.
Did we find
really?
That? I don't remember. People did not say. I think people didn't say they didn't like previews. Are you sure? I think I remember things saying that they did like it. No.
No. Ending episodes with a preview of what's next. 29% for binge watchers and 25% for schedule watchers said that they found it the least appealing. I think that's really interesting.
Oh, well, that's the least appealing of other things, but that's only 20 of us. Yeah, to me, this was a difficult survey to try to get things from, but I will say the more, because it's very tough, because one of the big findings, the first finding was that 90% of people do both. And it's true. I mean, I'm also mostly someone who likes to watch on a schedule, but this past weekend when Netflix released the final season of You, an awful, awful show that nonetheless is incredibly watchable. And my mom, I knew, was watching it too, and she wanted to talk about it. And so I said, you know what? Let me just get this over with. And even though with two or three episodes in, I'm like, I should just really stop watching this thing. It's dumb. And it was dumb. But I was like, you know what? The episodes are all there. Why not? I don't need to make this an event. I don't need to look forward to this. I wanted to get it done. And it was a harmless way to spend a weekend of TV viewing. So I didn't not enjoy it. But that kind of show, it'll be out of my mind. It almost is already out of my mind and will be completely out of my mind within like 3 weeks, right? It's not something that I want to remember, which is disposable TV, which is what Netflix, does very well. But there are a lot of people who still love weekly events and made a show like The Pit into a word of mouth hit because they were watching every week. Of course, there are now people who are going and doing slow motion binges of The Pit over the course of a week. I can't tell you how many people I've seen on social media saying, all of a sudden tweeting about, posting about The Pit because they're just now finally watching, because that's how people like
to
watch.
They can watch all of it now if they want in whatever sequence they want. Andor is an interesting combination, right? Where they are, because of the way the story is structured, they're releasing those weekly in 3-episode blocks. So it's like a mini binge every week, but it's also, they're going to do it over 4 weeks so that the conversation can continue. I think it's not a bad idea, especially since they're all the 3 episodes are sort of a kind, and then they move on to a different setting for the next 3 episodes.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of platforms being format agnostic and trying to experiment, because streaming does not have the limitations of linear TV. It is not limited by time slots or weekly schedules. There isn't a shelf space problem. So Netflix was smart to make it sort of splash the way it did. I continue to, and I think I've said this before on this show, I continue to think there are being sort of stubborn and high on their own supply for not experimenting with more. They've done some things where they'll break seasons into two, and some of their reality shows will sort of have mini binges, sort of like Andor. But they need more shows that are just weekly. I think a show like Pulse, which sort of came on and bombed, first needed to be good. But if it was even slightly good, it would have benefited from people having a new episode to talk about or sort of casually check out, as opposed to feeling they needed to watch everything at once. And I feel like people like all sorts of kinds of behaviors, or people have all sorts of kinds of behaviors. I think people say they only want sort of like to binge, but people will still watch things on a scheduled basis. You have to, I think there's something to say for curation and guiding viewers. Like, people always have the freedom to just, do it their own way. And look, it works in reverse. I think I've said this before too. I'm watching Netflix's Running Point and a few other Netflix comedies. I watch one episode a week on like Sundays or Mondays, and I'll just come back and just watch an episode. I did that with Nobody Wants This and A Man on the Inside. I watched both of those shows together over the course of 6 or 8 weeks, and it worked. It was fine because there weren't any spoilers I needed to worry about.
Right.
So yeah.
I also want to mention another little news story. This one came from you, pointing out something that is a constant refrain for me and Julia historically in this podcast, which is, hey, what's also good with streaming is bonus content. And so many different platforms don't post their bonus content in their apps, which I don't understand. But you wrote a piece about how Peacock has embraced the fact that they are the streaming home to Wicked, hit movie, very popular, and that they have gone in on the sing-along version, making of documentaries, deleted scenes, the bonus content that you often only see, like you remember it from a DVD or if you bought a Blu-ray or something like that. And they've seen some success with it, which just makes me want to make the point again, why not do this more? Like literally, Doctor Who on Disney Plus has a behind the scenes, has two behind the scenes things every episode, and they never get posted to Disney Plus. They're only on YouTube. And it's like, post them to YouTube. But like, if I'm literally watching the show, and I appreciate, so I'll say some positivity here. I appreciate that Max will tag the how we made this show on the end of the show. They literally after the credits, they put it on. At least it exists on the streaming service, because I'm in your app. I don't want to go to YouTube. I'm in your app already.
Well, and that's just, and the reason Max does that is because it's a continuation of what HBO has been doing for years.
Yes.
Right? HBO was Game of Thrones, exactly. Would have those things, and they've done that with House of the Dragon. And you know, sometimes you can tell when a show is not as successful anymore because they don't do it right, and they cut back on it.
Yeah, but it's in the Last of Us and for Hacks, they do it. Yeah.
And by the way, Hulu for a little bit for Only Murders in the Building. I actually wrote a story about this last summer. It was sort of disappointing because they had a great after show called One Question that actually won Emmys, or at least nominations for Emmys. That was sort of like some of the cast members coming on and playing a little game, but sort of going through that week's episode. And it's great because when you really love a show, you want more. If you really love a movie, you want more.
Yes.
And of course, it makes sense because what does it do? Like all these platforms all love to put out press releases to impress shareholders and advertisers with a number of minutes that get rack up on Nielsen. Well, guess what? I haven't been able to confirm this, but like I'm sure that to some degree this gets folded into the streaming time, or if it doesn't, it's still getting people to spend more time on the platform. So you're monetizing.
Absolutely.
It. But in general, Jason, I think what this also speaks to is something else I would love to see streamers do more of, which is just the further eventization of their movies, and not just with the bonus features, but and I've talked to Casey Bloys about this at HBO, who sort of thought that, because we talked about the fact that The Pitt and all Max originals now premiere Thursday nights at 9 o'clock, you know, in a linear time slot, right? They always did that with HBO shows because they were simulcast for cable at the same time they premiere on HBO cable, which still exists. Max doesn't have that. But they said, you know what? For the first couple of years, Max shows were just coming on at 3 a.m. like every other damn streaming show. Well, he changed that with Penguin and now Hacks and The Pitt. It's got a time slot. But for the movies, every time they have a new movie, they don't. They just will come on in the middle of the night and random days of the week, even though HBO still has its Saturday night movie slot. There are times where a movie will premiere on Max, like Barbie, on a Friday. It still doesn't go on to HBO proper until Saturday at 9 o'clock. Well, whatever time you do it, why not have your first showing of a movie every week? Like have Friday, even if it's not a big movie, why not make a promise that every week we're going to have a movie premiering on X day at this time? Mm-hmm. And two or three weeks of the month, it's going to be something from your sister studio. Maybe sometimes it's going to be a catalog movie that you've brought back. Maybe it's going to be a made for, whatever it is. There's no reason why not have the Max movie of the week and just have it promoting so people know, oh yeah, I got to open Max because that's, and more to the point, people understand that even you don't need that necessarily for something like Barbie because people are going to find that movie. They're counting the days till it's available on streaming. But what about a smaller movie that people don't even realize is on streaming? But if they know, hey, every Friday at 9 o'clock, there's a new movie on Max, they're going to check out the app.
Yeah.
It's going to be a showcase. It's because everyone in streaming wants to think they're reinventing the wheel. And I get that it is a different platform, but that doesn't mean some of the architecture of linear television cannot effectively be carried over.
Also, I think of things like that's where you get somebody on social media who is one of the stars or the writer or the director during the premiere
blog,
who's doing a tweet along, essentially post along. There's some value. I mean, you could make a thing out of it and it's going to get some attention, even if all that attention is, oh, that movie is on Peacock now or whatever.
Right.
And that there's value in that. I agree with
right.
you. completely.
Yeah,
so,
and don't get me started. There are some platforms that still, you know, CBS, which again is weird because they're a linear forward company. But on Paramount Plus, when they put episodes of, say, Elsbeth or Matlock, if you watch those shows on linear TV, you'll still see, like it's 1985. Stay tuned for scenes from next week's episode of Matlock, right?
Yeah.
And when you come back from the commercial, there's a 30-second teaser. You know, those teasers do not exist on Paramount Plus.
Interesting.
And it makes absolutely no sense, because why would you not immediately, you've got a captive audience, sell them? And but they don't, because someone figured, it's one more thing. Well, why not?
I want to mention briefly that Netflix results came out about 2 weeks ago, right after we recorded the last episode. And I wanted to mention it only because I know that Julia and I talk about this a lot. The Netflix isn't going to report subscribers anymore. And it's like Netflix has ascended to a higher plane of existence now, where they just say their revenue was up 13%. Their margin jumped up from 22% to 32%. Subscribers, you know, Julia wrote about this at Puck a little bit. Subscriber numbers in total probably dropped. But the point is that they're not even thinking about that anymore. They're all about like optimizing their profitability and their margin and becoming the most efficient business that generates, you know, huge amounts of money that they can be, which is a thing you do when you're number one. And I just think it's really interesting that that's where we are with Netflix, is that Netflix, and Julia's point is everybody else pointing out that they gain subscribers is because they're still playing the game of like, yeah, we're losing money, but we're gaining subscribers. Whereas Netflix is like, we have so many, our business is so great that it's all about increasing revenue, optimizing our video spend, increasing our margins and all of that. It's just kind of amazing that that's their business.
Well, for sure. But I would point out a couple things. One is they're also doing it in part because, even though they won't admit it, they reached a sort of a plateau,
yeah,
at least in the U.S., sooner than they thought. They, you know, you go back 5 years ago, they were thinking they would be able to get much bigger than they ultimately did. And they've done some of that by cracking down on password sharing. And that was part of that. But for whatever reason, they sort of are a little bit sort of, it's not as big as they thought. So let's be honest there. But also, yes, I 100% agree with the decision, because also they're not the first to do this. Amazon Prime Video has never regularly admitted how many people subscribe to it. And certainly they don't break out how many people subscribe just for the standalone service, which is an option. I don't think it's what a lot of people choose, because for roughly the same amount of money, you can get the full Prime experience with music and everything else. But they don't regularly update how many people have Prime, which is a subscription thing, and is TV. Same thing with Apple TV Plus or Apple Music. You know, it's sort of, I think what it says is that Netflix is sort of, they're not as big as Apple or Amazon, obviously, but they're really in that, they're sort of in the same sort of plane of Mount Olympus of media companies, right? I mean, they're certainly a FANG stock? Is Netflix?
Yes.
So why shouldn't they? But I also think it's good for sort of just sort of focusing on what's important. And also because they just, you know, they hate the media and want us all to suffer. I don't know. It's probably good, because, you know what, honestly, people don't look at the narratives the right way. I wish they would do even more on their viewership metrics, though. Their streaming ratings remain sort of are better than nothing. But because they don't update enough, and because they don't go beyond the top 10, there's still a lot of stuff we don't quite understand. But it is what it is. And at the end of the day, it is about how much money they make.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Apple did this about, I don't know, 8 years ago, something like that. They used to tell you how much revenue they made in each of their product categories, as well as how many units they sold, which was very useful because you'd get the average selling price. It's really nice. And then they're like, yeah, we're not going to give units anymore. We're only going to tell you about money. And it's interesting because money's, I mean, it's not a bad proxy, but it's not the same. And what it does is it allows them to optimize and sell fewer units, but more profitably. And all the world needs to know is that the number went up. And
yeah.
I get it. I get why they do that. But it's interesting to see. I mean, Netflix, look, Netflix is, if you had gone back like 4 years even and said, in the next 4 years, here's what Netflix is going to change, it would be amazing, because Netflix of 4 or 5 years ago felt like, you know, like, we're never going to do ads, and we're not, like, all these things, and we're never going to release data about who our viewed programs and all these things. And like, it's all like, they full credit to them. Well, they've just changed their tune as they've needed to.
I think I always thought that Netflix was going to eventually get ratings. They just wanted to get big enough. In terms of advertising, I didn't quite know, but it does make sense, because they went from trying to be HBO to trying to be all of cable. I still wish that they, I still think, you know, I wonder at what point do we get where something like Max sort of, right now they, they're sort of doing an ad-free and ad-supported version. But with HBO sort of carved out as the premium, you still don't get advertising in HBO stuff, even if you have the ad-supported. I think more streamers should do that. There should be a version of Netflix where you get ads on all the library stuff, but on new releases or new movies, you should have the option to sort of get more of a premium experience. Or when a Netflix show drops in its first season, it's ad-free, and then when a new season comes on, it goes into the ad tier. Because that way, because I think they'd probably get even more subscribers who'd be willing to pay for that. I might, because I watch very few library things on Netflix. So anyway, does that make sense?
Yep.
I don't know if that even makes any sense. It's just sort of in the weeds, but
it's all good. No, it's all good. All right. I have a topic that I wanted to bring up, but obviously I pay attention to this a lot, but I was wondering what you thought about it.
Is this sports?
No, it's Apple TV Plus.
I love Apple TV Plus.
The
one
information
of my favorite streamers.
A story like a month ago saying that, you know, Apple's losing $1 billion a year on it. Although, you know, they can afford it. Sounds like they're cutting costs somewhat, especially on the movie side, where they spent a lot of money for not a lot of benefit. But on the TV side, I think not so much. I feel like the output is really good. I am shocked at how much good stuff they put out over the last 5 years. Certainly, Hollywood loves that Apple is spending billions of dollars every year on content. That's really good. I just, you know, the question remains, what do they want to get out of it? Are they getting what they want? They get mentioned. They get praised for some of their shows. They get nominated for and win awards. But they seem fine with it the way it is. It is a thing that they can point to when they talk about their services revenue. Even though most of their services revenue is not coming out of Apple TV Plus, it gives a happy face to that revenue line that's mostly about subscriptions to Apple Care and money from Google for using their search engine in Safari and things like that. And they're like, oh, but it's Ted Lasso, it's Severance. I just wonder what you think about where Apple TV Plus is. And if you have any thoughts about sort of like what Apple wants to get out of this, and if they're happy with what they've got right now, even if they're losing money.
Yeah. Well, I'm also a fan of Apple like you. I watch several. It feels like there's always something I'm watching on Apple at any time. Right now, I'm currently every week I immediately watch The Studio and Your Friends and Neighbors. Is that what it's called? Your Friends and Neighbors?
And I haven't watched that yet, but it's been highly recommended to me.
It's
Studio
fun.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And it definitely feels like HBO of old in many ways. HBO still does some very good shows too, but they feel sort of a broader version of HBO. And so, first, with the caveat that you have to be humble when talking about companies like Apple, because no one really knows. I don't know the numbers of the economics or the subscriber numbers. We sort of have guesses and thoughts and guesstimates or whatever that might be there. I was talking to an agent, as luck would have it, this week, just about this topic, because there have been certain journalists who've written a lot about Apple, and my God, they're losing $1 billion, and not just the information, but I think Matt Bellany has done this as well. It's irresponsible. It's too much money. They're spending. First of all, remind you, remember how long the narrative revolving around Netflix was? They're losing so much money. Is it a Ponzi scheme? Are they going to, like, is everyone going to be left holding the bag? Or remember when Amazon started? And for years and years and years, Amazon didn't make money or barely made money. It was seen as sort of like this thing that, like, oh, it's got all this hype and it's trading at such a high level, but where's the money? And then one day a light switch went on and it was hugely profitable. Obviously, Apple doesn't have the first mover advantage of Netflix or Amazon, right? So it's not going to define the category in the same way those companies did. But there are many more ways to make money than we can see. There is the sort of the if you keep people in the ecosystem, that matters. If you keep people loyal to Apple and keep and loving your company, that matters. If you have sort of this, if you also create a library, eventually that could matter. I think a show like Ted Lasso, which they don't fully own because it's Sony or Warner Brothers, but they certainly, some of their other shows they do own, that matters because that will have a value longer term. I think in general, I don't know the economics of it for Apple, but I think for a streaming service, they there's a lot of places they can still go. They could eventually do an ad-supported version of Apple. They could eventually decide to bundle themselves with someone else or do what I wish they would have done, and they said they were sort of hinted they were going to do in the beginning, which is bundle themselves. You know, Apple could sort of subsidize Paramount and Peacock and sort of create a super channel, right? Of, you know, $12 a month and you get Paramount, Peacock, and Apple, and suddenly you've got NBC and CBS, the two of the top networks, and you've got premium programming, and wow, and it's selling advertising. Boy, that makes a lot of sense. You know, so they're definitely, you know, and they could push a lot of subscriptions to those companies. So, you know, I don't know what the long-term game is, but I do think that, you know, as, anyway, so the agent I was talking to said, like, direct revenue, relative content spend may have been $1 billion loss, but you don't know about everything else. I mean, they're building a big building in Culver City. Yeah. They have employees who work there. Like, people in the industry should not be, like, it's not our job as reporters to be cheerleaders for these people. But at the same time, if you're in Hollywood, you want Apple to succeed, because if they disappear tomorrow, you think things are bad now, you're going to get even, like, it's going to be even more of a depression, because Apple's making, they're spending a lot of money and they're making a lot of shows and they're keeping a lot of people employed and they're making a lot of writers, you know, be able to pay their rent and have careers. And if that disappears as a platform, that's, it becomes an even tighter market because there's less competition, and suddenly maybe HBO spends a little bit less and maybe Netflix spends a little bit less because there's less competition.
Right.
So, you know, this is, tech companies are about expanding their direct relationship with consumers, and Apple TV does that very well, very brilliantly. And because it can be bundled with Apple One and with Apple Music, it, to me, it's logical. And will they eventually reduce the number of shows they do? Possibly. Maybe they need to, but they're still trying to make movies in theaters. They're sort of, you know, they've got a big Brad Pitt movie coming out this summer, and it's going to be in theaters first. And if it's a hit, well, that's a good thing too, because that movie will live on Apple. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think that this is that classic thing where Apple is playing a different game. They don't have the same economics as somebody like Netflix that has that this is their entire business. I think they like the halo effect of having good programming, well thought of programming, wins awards, they're considered for awards, they have a good relationship with the creative community. This is part of it too, is that they, you know, in Apple's DNA is this, you know, being the champions of the tools for creative people. And honestly, I know it seems wild to say, oh, they lost $1 billion in this particular division, but like, their business is so huge at this point that that's not a big deal. And if it's got the right ancillary business that has positive effects, the billion doesn't matter. And I do think that they really like the fact that they are building a brand. You know, their brand is so well known, and yet they're building a brand for content. And again, I will say, nobody would have predicted 5 years ago that the quality of the content would be as high as it is, because it really is very good. It is. I know it's a cliche almost to say that it's sort of trying to beat HBO or play the old HBO game. But that one of the problems of David Zaslav's HBO is he kind of wrecked what the HBO brand stood for. And now it's kind of a little bit of this and a little bit of Max and whatever. And you know, Apple very clearly looked at classic HBO, and they had Richard Plepler from HBO as one of their advisors early on, like saying that's our model, is we don't need to have a really high volume, but we want everything to be pretty good and tuned into a few kind of like key categories of audience. And I think they've done a good job. It's not perfect, but I think they've done a really good job with their content.
And it feels premium in a way that other streamers don't, because again, there was such a chorus of people, especially journalists, who kept saying, you need to invest in a library, you need to give reasons. And look, there are some people who think, oh, there's nothing on Apple, right? Well, first of all, there is plenty on Apple. But, you know, the reason to have, you know, streaming is not just so you have a whole bunch of shows to scroll through and then eventually switch off the app and watch something else or watch a rerun of Friends, right? There are plenty of places you can do that. What I know with Apple is, oh, they've got a new show. I'm going to check it out. I might not like every show, but I'm going to check it out. I'm going to be intrigued by it. And to me, for spending $10 a month or less, if you buy a new device for a few months, it makes sense. And it's sort of, there's a guy who writes a newsletter out of Australia that I highly recommend to your readers called Always Be Watching. His name is Dan Barrett. And even though he's in Australia, he writes from a sort of global perspective. And so he'll have, you know, talking about moves that Netflix makes and Amazon, which again are global platforms. So it makes sense. And he talked recently about the importance of soft power in cultural programming. In other words, America had a lot of soft power in the 50s, 60s, and 70s because of our cultural exports, because we made so much of the world's television and movies that, like, people wanted to be Axel Foley. They wanted to be, like, you know, they saw Indiana Jones, all this American, that it, the halo around America was great because of our culture, right? I think there's also soft power in programming for Apple, in that making all this great content increases the halo around Apple. Yep. And it again, like I said earlier, it gets you, it lets them have a direct relationship that they, in the same way they hold a beautiful iPad in their hands or an iPhone or the very first iPod, they can look at these bespoke television shows and think, that's an Apple show. It's not just another place I go for streaming.
I did a piece about, for people who might be churning through, or the people who say that there's not much of a catalog, like,
oh, so much.
There's at least a dozen TV shows that I would personally highly recommend. At least a dozen. And, you know, a handful of movies and a handful of docuseries. And that's just the stuff I've seen. There's stuff that when I wrote that story, people are, what about this show? And I'm like, I haven't seen it. I've heard it's good, but I haven't seen it. So there's a lot of good stuff there.
No, and there's a cadence. There's this, and by the way, another thing they do in terms of where they're really, again, I think they're better with their ecosystem is they'll have there's a row on there that's just coming up on Apple, and it has, you go through and it shows what the show is, or if it's a movie, and when it's premiering, and then you can have a preview, and then you can add it to your list. And it's just, and you just go through it. I think it's a smart way to get people, hey, were you thinking of canceling now that you've finished the season of Shrinking? Look what else is coming. And it's very smart, and I think it works, because it shows that, you know, now there are times where they have two or three different shows airing at the same time, whereas early on it was just, you know, one new show a quarter or a month.
Yeah. It's it's good stuff. Yeah, Murderbot is coming in a couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to that too. There's always something else. That's the trick. Before we go, I always like to give a recommendation of something that we've been watching that people might want to check out. I don't know if you've got anything that you've been thinking of that you've been watching that you'd like to turn people on to.
Well, I've mentioned this before, and I think we've said this before. Have you mentioned the studio already on a previous show?
I don't know if I have. So let's mention it. Yeah.
I am not the world's biggest Seth Rogen fan. I don't hate Seth Rogen. I love Freaks and Geeks. He's fine. He's very Seth Rogen-y. I didn't see the thing he did when he was in Korea, and he's a little body, whatever. And, you know, and I certainly haven't watched The Boys, which I didn't even realize in my mind. I forgot that he was producer on The Boys. So I was a little skeptical. Seth Rogen, Hollywood, is this going to be bad Entourage? But no, this is good Entourage. This is better than Entourage. This is sort of a little bit of Curb Your Enthusiasm, a little bit of Larry Sanders, even, in terms of the manic energy of it all. And it's just a great look at a Hollywood film studio. It is very much a satire. It's not realistic in many ways, and yet it's very realistic thematically or spiritually.
I've heard people who've said it's all true. They've seen that happen in the business.
The vibe is absolutely true, even if some of the hijinks they get into are very much, it reminds me of a screwball comedy, you know?
Yeah.
Shot, every episode, I think, is shot with a single shot. I think they one episode that was all about a single shot in a film, but I think for the most part, if not, the camera style may not be one single shot, but everything's very much, you're constantly following the character, so it's got an amazing visual style. Yeah. And it's just, and episodes can be tight. They're as little as 25 minutes, which is amazing in this day and age. So there's very little fluff. And it's just, I look forward to it. And the only thing that sucks is that I think there are only going to be 10 episodes, which is more than some comedies, but like there should be at least 13 to 14 a season. And I think they could get it done. But I think it's already been renewed for a second season. It's a great cast. Ike Barinholtz is also in it, and he's great. And by the way, I'm sort of on a weird Ike Barinholtz sort of kick right now, because in addition to watching The Studio, I'm also now watching a show that he's a writer and producer on called Running Point on Netflix, which premiered a few months ago. I think if you're a binger, you've already seen it, but it's not a great show, but if you liked shows like The Mindy Project or sort of other Mindy Kaling style shows, she's also an EP. It's that way. It's sort of like the Laker Dynasty show that HBO did a couple years ago, but it's the from the point of view of the daughter in the comedy. And so there's a little First and 10 going way back to HBO's early days. Have you seen it?
I have not. That's Celebrity Jeopardy champion Ike Barinholtz, by the way.
Exactly. Very smart. Who, by the way, and there's a character in there who plays one of the brothers in the show who really looks like Ike Barinholtz. And I was convinced it was because I saw his name as a producer on the credits. It's not. But apparently he's good friends and people say they get mistaken all together. There's sort of dirtbag Ike Barinholtz, but it's got the Ike Barinholtz energy because he's a writer on the show and producer. And it's sort of, Mindy Project, New Girl, that sort of thing. It's not going to, I don't think it should win any Emmys for writing for comedy, but it's a fun little hang. And it's, I definitely enjoy watching an episode of it every day. So those are my two picks.
All right, that's Running Point on Netflix. You didn't even mention Catherine O'Hara is in The Studio. She's also in the second season of The Last of Us. She's having a moment. It's great. All deserved.
Icon.
I'm going to, and I know that a lot of people will just roll their eyes because they've already heard this and they know it and all, but I'm just going to make a little pitch here. On Disney Plus, Andor came back for season 2. It's going to be 2 and done. They're only doing 2 seasons. It leads into the Star Wars movie Rogue One that Tony Gilroy helped sort of salvage, and so he wrote a bunch of that. And Andor, the TV series, is a prequel. And all I'll say is, if you're a fan of really good premium prestige television drama and you poo-poo Star Wars because it's silly sci-fi for the kids and all that, you should watch Andor season 1 and 2. It is a prestige drama that about some serious topics that also happens to be set in Star Wars, but it is maybe the best thing that has ever been made in the Star Wars world. I mean, seriously.
Wow.
And if it's not that, it's the best thing since The Empire Strikes Back, at least. So even if you're not a huge Star Wars fan, even you only vaguely know it, and you were like, I'm not going to watch a TV show, Mandalorians and Baby Yodas and all of that, watch Andor. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's so good. It's just so good. And it is about stuff, but also very entertaining on top of it. And that's second and final season currently dropping on Disney Plus, 3 a week.
Is it depressing at all, Jason, though? Because I hear that it's supposedly about fascism and has shades of Trump and all that, I'm not in for that.
What
right
it
now.
Is it's about how you form a rebellion. Because remember, we know from Star Wars that they have a rebel alliance and they blow up the Death Star and they win. This is who decides to be the rebels and where do they come from and what makes them make those decisions and how do they rise up? And I would say that ultimately I find it pretty uplifting, but it also is about like who will stand up and be counted when there's tyranny and somebody needs to fight against it. And that's what Andor is about.
So what you're saying is J.B. Pritzker, Andrea Ocasio-Cortez, you need to be watching this show.
Yeah, I'm going to get so many letters now, Joe.
Oh, people, if you happen to be on that persuasion, God love you. We're all Americans. We're all humans.
Yeah.
The guy you believe in is a cult leader.
There's always somebody
whatever.
Who writes in and says, how dare somebody who doesn't have my exact opinions say that they have opinions? It's like, okay, well, get over it. We're all different and we all have different opinions. And
feel free to start a podcast
those folks have, it's okay. We all have to agree on everything. It's okay.
Can't we all just get along?
To the end of this episode of Downstream. We do Downstream Plus. This was full size for everybody, but the next episode will be partial for those who aren't subscribers. Check it out, downstream.plus. Thank you for supporting the show if you are a subscriber, and if not, give it some consideration. I am at sixcolors.com and appear on many other podcasts at Relay and theincomparable.com. You can send us feedback, downstreamfeedback.com. And you can find Joe at Vulture, where you should subscribe to the Buffering newsletter. Right? It's free.
It's free. It's, you know, you're not going to pay a lot for this mattress or this newsletter. So
I love it.
So download it.
And we will be back in a couple of weeks. I think Julia will be back for that one. But thanks to everybody out there for listening. And thanks once again to Joe for coming on. We'll see you next time.